bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting. Hello, welcome to the Photo Show. It's the weekend. It's Friday. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's not Crackerjack. It's me and Alex Fox talking the photo news and answering your questions. Yes, we've got three this week. Good ones as well. Good ones. Joining me, Alex G. Fox. How you going, pal?
Good afternoon. I'm okay, thank you.
Now, you've been working hard again.
I know. It's not good for you, you know?
Yeah, do you know, good, mate?
I'll be honest, I'm falling to bits. Honestly, I woke up, say a week now, Friday. So I woke up Wednesday with a slight, you know, tingle in the neck. And by Friday evening, I could hardly move. It hurt so much. And, I mean, you're aware of my war injuries, and I have quite a bad back. And because I've been walking funny with my neck, I got up this morning, and I could hardly move my legs because of my back. So I'm in this chair, and I can't really move because I'm more or less strapped into it with various things that the chiropractor gives
me. I hope the lady that you paid to do that is coming back to release you at some point.
Yeah, exactly. I'm waiting for the wife to come home.
Oh, right. No.
And then I've got my excuses ready. Yeah.
Yeah, no. You've been joining maps, you said, this week.
Yes. I don't know. Well, they were 16th century hand-painted maps of Britain, but the persons that did it think that one day someone would say, oh, I need those all put together into a nice one big map.
Well, people are going to call me a Philistine, but I don't get the point of that, because they're probably wrong anyway. Most of that coastline is washed away if they were even right in the first place. So
yeah, I know, but
why bother keeping them, eh?
Exactly. The paintings of Henry VIII didn't exactly look exactly like Henry VIII either, but we're not throwing them away on the grounds that...
Well, there's no photo evidence to the contrary, so that's the trouble.
Exactly.
We've had a review. Thank you very much. It's from Circular Runner, and he left this. This podcast is part of my photo education. Cheers, mate. I started listening to the Photo Show about 6 months ago. I knew absolutely nothing about photography or cameras, but for work, I needed to learn them ASAP. I'm a big fan of podcasts and listen to a ton of them, yet you and Chris and Alex were so interesting from the get-go, and I stayed with them. Somehow, along the way, I've managed to learn quite a bit more about what to look for in cameras and how to get the right gear for what I want to do with it. Aperture, megapixels, lenses, camera bodies, editing apps. These guys cover all the aspects of photography from gear to technique, and I look forward to every Sunday when I can listen to the newest podcast. You and the guys are obvious experts.
So somebody has already admitted he didn't know anything about photography.
I do recall there is a review in the same iTunes store that calls us a bunch of twats, but never mind. But they don't lord it over each other. In fact, they are open to listeners' submitted questions, and I sent one, and the following week, the pros took time to discuss it on air. This is a great show for the newbie like me, but also great for more experienced photographers. So give it a chance. It's one of the better photography podcasts out there, and believe me, I've tried most of them. Thank you very much. That's Circular Runner in the iTunes store. If you'd like to leave us a review... Reviews make a huge difference to position in iTunes. The more reviews you've got, the more likely you are to stay at the higher levels in the podcast charts. So you can help us no end. If you like the show, if you want to do us a favour, you can donate as well if you want to donate to the network. But even if you don't want to do that, that's fine. Just leave us a review. Be really grateful. Makes a huge difference. And we'll read all of them out. Every review that we get, we read out on air. So thank you very much, Circuit Runner. Very kind. The Week in Photography. It's not been a bad week, actually. There's some good news to start off with, and the good news is related to Jessup's, but it's not Jessup's-ish. This is two guys that worked at the Bicester store in Oxfordshire, here in the UK. There were two managers at the place, Paul Crockett and Robert Peckham, and they'd worked at the Bicester branch for 6 years, and they've decided that they were going to take on the store themselves. So they contacted Fuji, who had the print machines and so on and the scanners, and they said, would you help us out? And Fuji said, yeah, sure, we'll give you them free of charge, which I thought was blooming marvellous. They've got 10 grand's worth of equipment straight away that they can set their business up with. But, and there is a big but, apparently the people who've been put in charge by PricewaterhouseCooper of getting rid of the lease want 15 grand off them. So it might all get to nothing at the moment. But I thought we should cover that because we give Jessup's a good kicking. And we did, you know, a lot of people think that I hate every member of staff that ever worked for Jessup's. I hate the ones in Oxford Street that ignored me, and that was it. But the problem is they were tired with the brush. But we like independent camera shops with people who are bothered, and it seems like these two are bothered. So any thoughts, mate?
Yeah, it's a good story. It's a good idea. Oxfordshire is a fairly well-to-do part of the country. So, you know, you're going to have people that, you know, they're going to come in and they're going to use a facility. I mean, it's a good idea because they've handpicked a store, obviously the store they were in, but they've handpicked the store to say, you know, there is custom for this area and for this store. It's not bad.
They'll know the footfall, they'll know the customers. Yeah. They've got a lot of inside knowledge.
They're going to have a lot of goodwill towards them as well, because if I was anywhere near Oxfordshire, I'd go in.
Yeah, I'd be in there now.
Yeah, and I'd just say, well, what can I buy from you? What can you do for me? Because I think you know, you deserve my, you know, my pennies. The one thing about that story that slightly worries me is the fact that your hatred of Jessop's Oxford Street is, I think Jessop's Oxford Street is the only one that they think is going to survive.
Oh, Jesus.
So just to let you know that their flagship store is due to be relaunched, and that's something I read quite recently.
I think Jessop's as a brand is gone. I think the problem was that there was good staff. I'm not saying there wasn't, but there was too many. There was, and it might only be a minority, but there was too many bad staff who got the reputation.
Well, I didn't really want to get into the big Jessop argument at the time, but the last one I did go to, I pulled the guy up because of I'd ordered something online and I was in a real hurry. I went there and between giving him my piece of paper that had my order number on it and him handing me the receipt, he never said a word to me.
Right.
And I just basically, I don't blame Jessop's. I mean, this is before they got into real trouble, or before we knew how big a trouble they were.
Yeah.
And I was suitably unimpressed that as I walked out muttering under my breath and he was talking absolute nonsense to this woman that wanted to some advice about a camera, I took the trouble to turn around and say to her, there must be someone else in this store or another store in this mall to go to because of the guys talking utter crap. Yeah. And I smiled at him and walked out. So that was my last thing in Jessop's, but that was just one member of staff who was particularly obnoxious. And I dare say if he was selling burgers or anything else, he would have been quite just as rude and badly behaved. So I don't think that's a Jessop's.
Chat room's chipping in. Windrider's saying, like the legal profession, 99.9% of them get the rest of bad name. I think there was a lot more than 1.1% that were doing the bad stuff, but I agree, it's minority probably getting the majority of bad name. But a bad management system was the root of the problem. And Potter Paul says, good for them, and I agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, another one about the Jessop start. I mean, you get to a point in any business where, you know, you as a manager is getting so much pressure on you to cut every corner whatsoever. You're not going to get good staff when you're not going to be able to pay them a reasonable wage. And I think that's another reason Jessop's got in trouble. They were cutting costs and cutting. They tried to expand where there wasn't a market, and they ended up having to cut every cost because the banks were wanting their money back. And it got to the point where it fell down. And back to this story. The 15 grand wanting for the lease, they go and whistle, because whoever owns that store that is holding the lease, if Jessop's go under, Jessop's, the figures came out recently about Jessop's, I think it was only a couple of days ago, and they basically owe an awful lot more than
They're in hot
people
too.
Thought they did.
Yeah.
And there's basically no... There's nothing left. There's no stock left. I mean, Canon have got screwed. It's funny because I didn't notice Nikon got screwed. So Nikon must have got their money.
No, Canon were big parties in supporting, and there was talk of Canon investing more in Jessop's to keep it running, but they were already in Hockton for 20 million.
Yeah. I mean, I noticed of all the main manufacturers, Nikon seems to have walked out of there not with any problem, which is interesting. They obviously didn't want to be party to it. And maybe if Nikon had the same attitude as Canon, we might still be looking at Jessop's now. That's another point. But anyone that owns the lease, e.g. the landlord of that store, is not going to get anything for that store for the next 5 years. If Jessop's go, which they will go, the administrators are going to have to draw a line under it eventually. That landlord is going to have an empty shop. If he leaves these guys in there, forget about the 15,000. If he leaves these guys in there, at least they're going to be paying the rates and things like that, which means the landlord won't have to.
Oh, absolutely agreed. But I think the only problem you're going to have is the fact that Jessop's own that lease still as an asset, and to sublet it could be a viable way of recouping monies for their creditors. So
They will not be able to.
They're going to hold on to it long enough to stop these two guys getting their dream, which could be a bit of a problem.
Well, that would just be absolutely...
It'd be crass.
It would go against what's actually useful, because if I wanted to take a shop, I'd take the shop next door that's going to give me 2 years free and all the rest of the stuff. There's no way I'm going to take a 15,000 lease on a shop that's proven to not have enough footfall to keep it going. You know, these guys, what they want to do is say, okay, fair enough. There must be a shop two doors down. There'll be a shop everywhere because they're all empty. Just pick up your beautiful stuff, the food you've been kind enough to give you. I will come down to Oxford and help you move it, right? We'll move it into the shop 2 days, two stores down, and it will get you your 2 years free lease or whatever, you know? I'll come down and help you personally. There'll be hundreds of us that would do that. So whoever's looking after this Jessop stuff, just pull your head out of the sand and, you know, maybe something out of this could leave us with a smile on it.
Good on him.
Yes, good on you, boys.
This is Sophie Ellis and Patrick Eggert. They're both photographers. They met on Flickr. They started a relationship, and just over a year ago, Sophie flew 5,000 miles to Portland when they finally met in real life, and they've turned their whole episode into a photo blog, including a proposal by Patrick, and I'm going to move on before we vomit.
No, I thought of the worst.
Oh, don't.
No, I thought of the worst joke in the history of all my bad jokes.
Go on then, mate.
You reckon they clicked?
Oh, that's disgusting. That's more puke worthy than the frigging story.
I know, but as soon as you said it, it just went through my head and I thought, oh no, be quiet. I've got some credibility left. And now I haven't.
Oh, chat room's groaning. I've never seen a chat room groan before. Jeez.
But all the girls are going to think I'm quite cute now, so I'll be all right. She's very pretty, though, isn't she?
Well, yeah, but she's kind of freaky. She flew 5,000 miles to meet him. Jeez.
Right, desperate. They're still pretty.
I met you guys on the internet, but I don't want to date you. Ever shot a test pattern? You must have shot a test pattern in your life, mate.
Only hundreds of thousands of times.
Exactly. We've all got those little graphs with the colour squares on and the greyscales. Well, apparently the US government have got their own. But their test patterns are the size of airfields, and they've got huge chunks, and I mean huge, we're talking whole military bases full of concrete that are all painted in specific patterns and specific diagrams, and Google Earth's found them. And they reckon that they were used to calibrate the cameras on the SR-71 Blackbird and the U-2 spy planes in the 50s and 60s. But they're all still out there, and you can shoot them from space, they're visible from space with a long lens. And you can see whether your lens is calibrated properly. Yeah. I mean, I think that's magic.
You know, when they pinpoint satellites, maybe that's how they get the, get them focused properly. Maybe that's how they fixed the Hubble. They just turned it around and refocused it on this.
Yeah. Did you see my rig the other night for trying to take a picture of the space station?
Yeah, I was. I looked at that and I was thinking you might have balance issues.
Well, I took a picture of the moon pretty well, and the picture of the moon was crisp and nice. It was good. Shot F11, really good. Came out beautifully. The one of the space station was a lot. I got a blur, and I got a blur with wings. The blur with wings wasn't too bad. It was quite impressive, but I couldn't get anything sharp. I mean, my eyesight's gone. I can't focus in manual anymore.
There's that Damon. What's his name? Damon Albarn and Paul McCartney. Isn't that a blur with wings?
Oh, good God, Jesus.
Oh, it's two in one go.
Where's Alex Fox? What have you done with him?
Oh, no, I've been working so hard all week. I haven't really spoken.
The Alex Fox I know doesn't crack jokes. And while we're on the subject of the military, here's a picture of the atomic explosions. They've released these. They've come out of secrecy things. And they're the close-up images of nuclear explosions at sea. And they're really high-res versions as well. They've scanned them and put them all up from the original photos that were taken. This is a blast. It lifted 2 million tons of water and sand into the air, created a 6,000-foot column that was 2,000 feet wide with walls that were 300 feet thick. And there's a close-up version. You can see a little black mark on the bottom of that mushroom cloud.
That's a boat.
That's a ship.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a boat, mate. That's an aircraft carrier that's vertical from the explosion.
You know what?
I love that.
It's incredible in its hideousness, if that's right.
It
that's
is.
Not a joke.
It's awesome just, in its power.
If that was a natural occurrence, I'd probably have that picture on my wall. Mm. But knowing what the picture is of, it sends shivers down my spine. But, you know, what a photograph.
It is superb. Absolutely amazing.
Like I say, great imagery, but not something.
There's a lot of images have come out this week. There's one of the 180 or 360 pano of London, which is supposed to be really nice, and it's something ridiculous like 4 million gigapixels or, you know.
Yeah, I actually saw that being revealed on the BBC. It was on the One Show, and the photographer had brought in his small version. And the small version he'd printed rolled all the way out of the studio.
It was 100 foot long, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was the small version. But, you know, this is the guy that does the panoramics of the city. You know, I think we've talked about him before. But this
cloudy
one,
day, though.
Yeah, well, you know, once you start, you really sort of, you can't really stop, can you?
No, great.
I mean, 48,000 images. But this is from memory, I could be wrong, but 48,000 images, and I'm really had a bad week because I've been joining.
You've got to be stitching those together with something automatically.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you do, but
Canon Pano's not going to cope with it, is it? But
no,
or Pano 360 in the iOS store.
Because he did that on the top of the British Telecom Tower, which is a revolving tower in London. So he used the tower actually as his rotation aid, if you like.
Well, it's only the restaurant that rotates, isn't it? And that's closed.
Yeah, that's where he was. He was.
Was he in?
Yeah, it was the restaurant rotating, which was how he took the picture.
Oh, right.
But, I mean, they are incredible. I mean, they're wonderful images. I've got a few. There was one of somewhere like the Sistine Chapel I looked at about a year ago. And, it was only a couple of thousand images. But it was just a remarkable experience to be able to move around the Sistine Chapel at that level of detail.
Mm.
I mean, you know, I'd love it, but what... It's a beautiful museum piece. I imagine someone like the Museum of London could do really well to have an iMac, and you just sit in the middle of this iMac, or it's projected and you can walk around, because it's a lot better as a projection than it is as a print. I think there's something about it being projected that makes it more interesting.
Yeah.
So I'd love, you know, like a, if you like a reverse iMac, so it's coming from the back of the screen, so you're at no point in the way of the image. And possibly if you could then use your hands to spread it and go into more detail, that would be amazing. So there's definitely a future for these things. And maybe if you can tap on historical imagery on top of it with a computer, so you can sort of look at part of the image and then you can like slide back in time to see how that part of the image would have looked years ago.
Mm.
I mean, it's a really, really good tool, but, you know, someone will use it. But, you know, it's a great thing. I think historically it's really important as well.
So you can look at London on a grey day, which is probably about 363 of them.
Yeah.
Excellent.
At least 368 have extra.
A couple of camera reviews. First one is right up Alex's alley. It's the D7100. And he said 7150 then, and everyone would have gone out looking for a new model. This is a crop frame sensor camera. It's 24.1 megapixels, CMOS sensor. It's got an ISO range of 1 to 6400, expandable to 25600, which is a hell of a leap from the 64. And it's got an interesting 1.3 crop mode, which crops it down even further from where it is. But it does it, I guess, it doesn't actually give you anything bigger in terms of pixels, because it takes it down to 15 megapixels. So it's just effectively blacking off one part, like the old APS system was with Kodak. It's supposedly, Alex, for the advanced enthusiast. I'm guessing that's more because of the price than the features, though.
Well, I don't know. The features, because one of these this 1.3 crop thing, the idea of it is actually to give you an inbuilt 2x telephoto lens. So it's basically...
But it doesn't add to the crop, does it? It's not like a... See, the cropping on a standard crop sensor is actually the fact that the lens is pushed closer to it, therefore it's a physically enlarged image on the sensor, whereas this cropping reduces it to 15 megapixels, which proportionally is a reduction of 1.3, so therefore it's effectively doing no more than just blanking off some of the pixels, as far as I can see.
Well, no, it's if you, in the old days when we wanted to, you know, when camera technology, especially with film, in fact, you'd you know, you crop to zoom, if you like. But what this is doing, it's got some sort of algorithm where, you know, obviously a 2x telephoto, if you think about it properly, if you actually wanted to shoot on the normal 24 megapixel and you wanted to do a 2x telephoto crop in the machine, you'd actually effectively only end up with a 6 megapixel image, because remembering it's not only top to bottom, it's left to right as well. So what it's doing, it's somehow very cleverly, I think, giving you, I mean, obviously, I don't know if it's interpolated or interpolated or what, but somehow it's given you the ability to turn a 6 megapixel crop into a 15.4 megapixel crop, which for an amateur, if you're on holiday, and, right, good example, on this image, you've got an 18-105 DX lens. With what's in there, you don't need, let's face it, you don't need 24 megapixels to go and take your holiday snaps. But would be nice is to be able to have an 18-210 lens and still only be carrying around 1.18-1.05 lens. In that respect, I think it's very clever to have it on board. Hence, that's why you could say it's an enthusiast plus camera. It's just another feature that people... You've always had the ability to do it with software. But this is another example of putting something on board that's actually, you know, quite a clever idea. I suspect it's purely an electronic thing. I doubt they've got the old telephoto flick over internal something or other that goes over the sensor. Because if they did, that would be brilliant, but it'd just be one more thing to get filthy and get in the way and cause you all sorts of trouble.
Yeah, well, sorry, go ahead.
No, just say, as an idea, I think it's very good. This is sort of what Nikon needed to do, because of they'd moved their lower end of the FX range so high now. I mean, low end FX range on Nikon is incredible, but their high end DX range was not anywhere in comparison. And I think this is, if you like, bridging the gap between their DX and their FX, because there's people out there that may have, you know, you could. DX lenses are still expensive. And if you had a DX, old DX or older version, say a D90 or something, you could have easily spent £1,000 on lenses. Now, this is a new body for, which is about £1,100? I can't remember now. It's a body for about £1,100 that's making full use of all the lenses you've already got, but bringing you up, really is bringing you up a level. It's bringing you up to the low-end FX level as opposed to, you know, a medium-range DX level.
Yeah, the only thing that bothers me about looking at the specs that are on this and the pricing is you're talking about lens kit at $1,600, body only at $1,200, $1,300 in the States. Here you're talking about $1,100 for body only and $1,300 for lens kit. And for that amount of money, you're pushing then at the end of the, if you were talking about buying from a fresh, you know, for another £200, you're buying... £300, you're buying something that's a lot better in either Canon or Nikon, I think.
Yeah,
but it's that squeezy in the middle that's not in the middle, you know?
No, I agree, but this was always the price that Nikon came in with their 300S. I think the 700 was slightly more. This was always the price range they had for their top of the range DX. It was always at this point. And there are plenty of reasons to use a DX camera over an FX camera. There really is. I mean, DX lenses are cheaper, but also you've got an 18-105 here, which is probably, what's that, a VR2 18-105, complete guess, say it's £400, I don't know, but it's maybe even less. The equivalent of that on the FX, which they've only just brought out 18mm FX lenses, are substantially more. So if you're an enthusiastic amateur, you're saying I could spend £1,000 on a set of lenses that are really going to do everything I possibly want. But once you go up to the FX range, you're talking about 2 or 3 times that amount for anything similar to cover the same ranges. So I would say for someone that's not making their living out of photography, this is the most sensible place to start. And,
praise
you know,
indeed.
A 24 megapixel DX sensor, you know, I mean, I'd say that's pushing it to the limit, the same as the 36 megapixel FX sensor.
Mm.
So you've got room to play. You've got, you know, I think, I'm not sure they're going to go much further with this level of sensor, because if they do, the thing's going to just start getting crappy and it's going to have loads of noise on it. But, you know, this is the camera I think they've been waiting to make, and I don't know why they've held on, but this is the very top end of an amateur enthusiast level camera that you're going to get. And bearing in mind, the video is going to be excellent. The low noise is going to be excellent on it. Most people could use this for work. Unless you're trying to shoot something that's very, very fast, most photographers could, portrait photographers, anyone that's got studio work, you could all use a camera like this very, very simply. As long as speed's not an issue and you've got control over lighting, this camera would do nearly everyone perfectly fine.
Pentax have got out the MX1. We've got some review images and stuff for that. This is a 4x optical zoom compact camera, f1.8, 28mm wide coverage at most, ISO range of 100 to 12,800. It supports automatically Adobe DNG, so it's outputting straight away to that, which I think is a very positive thing. 1080p movie. It's much of a muchness. It's priced in at £400 at the moment from Wex, $500-ish. I like the look of this, but again, with Pentax, they've just, it's gone on price for me. For £500, I can buy an awful lot more camera in the compact market than this.
Yeah, I mean, you're right, the specs on it are fine. This DNG thing really interests me, because I'm beginning to think with the fact that Adobe and various, so well, Adobe is the only real one, but they're starting to get people, they're trying to bend people over a barrel. You've experienced the problem recently yourself with them not updating the camera raw for anything other than their, you know, newest piece of kit. I mean, I'm using 5. How old is that? It's not very old.
5 to 12 months.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And I go and buy a new camera tomorrow. I've then got to spend another £800 on 6. Or whatever it is, you know, because I upgrade all of them.
But, I mean, this is an interesting thing, because I seriously thought about buying 6, and I downloaded the trial, and I think I would have bought 6 if I hadn't downloaded the trial. But downloading the trial, I realised 6 is not good. 6 is not a nice user experience at all. If you look at the RAW conversion process and the RAW adaption process, whether it's from DNG or from the CR2 file on the 6D, it's not pleasant. The adaptability and understanding of the sliders has completely changed.
I think there's a real place in the market. There are pieces of software to do this, but there's a real place in the market for somebody, I don't know, somebody not 100% into photo, you know, just photo stuff. Someone like Coral, someone that does something else, to bring out an all-sing, all-dancing, really, really powerful RAW converter. Even Apple, you know. They could, if someone brought it out,
Apple
could
RAW.
Charge, yeah, you could charge £100.
That's the ultimate walled garden, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but the point is, if you charge £100 for something that it's what most of us need, because of we were talking earlier, there's certain things in Photoshop I need, but I don't need them in Photoshop 6. I can do them in certain other softwares if I had them.
I want to walk away from Photoshop desperately at the moment, but there isn't anything out there that does everything that I need. I've got to go across 10 different packages maybe to get exactly what I want. I can do layers in Illustrator. I can change a little bit in Illustrator here and there. I can do text in Illustrator far better than I can do it in Photoshop over images. But when it comes down to it, Photoshop just works pretty well.
I think what's really odd, Adobe have the DNG converter, which, you know, it's fine, but it does. Once you've converted from DNG, I just feel, again, something else we discussed, I just feel that you're maybe losing some of the options on noise reduction and things that you had originally. I just feel that once you've done one conversion, doing a second conversion, it's always best to go from your original to what you want your final conversion to be, rather than having to jump another step. Now, the only person that make a piece of software that allows you to do that is Adobe, and they're the people we're sort of trying to get away from in this example. Adobe probably has to do that because of the EU. Probably would not stand for them having a piece of software wasn't, you know, compatible with everyone. I'm amazed that the camera manufacturers are sort of able to get away, but they do. They bundle some crappy little thing with every camera that allows you to convert some sort of RAW to something else. It doesn't matter how, you know, how it's done. They have to bundle it, because I don't think the EU get away with it. But I really, honestly, I think the EU is really bad for a lot of things, but this is the type of thing they're really good at for us consumers. And I really think they need to look at this and say, look, the average Joe in the street, yeah, okay, you can shoot JPEG, and there's the inconvenience of all this. They really need to say, okay, well, every manufacturer, like we just looked at with this Pentax, every manufacturer has to produce a universal output as well as their proprietary output, not just JPEG. So no one's silly enough to want to produce TIFFs out for every camera because, of you know, most people can't use them. But having a DNG or some European standard, which isn't Adobe, would be nice. Having some standard output as well as their all-singing, all-dancing output, I'm really not sure why it's been allowed to carry on, because I really think, as consumers, it's an issue for us. And not just pros, for everyone.
No, I agree. I think the EU have been pretty lax on smacking Adobe for for the
smacked Apple, they've smacked Microsoft over the years. I think Adobe's due for a little bit of a kicking.
I think the profile's not big enough, because you've got to be in the world of photography to know that Adobe's becoming an issue. And if you look at the consumer end of Adobe, when you look at things like Elements and so on, they're actually fairly egalitarian with that. And there's an awful lot I could do quite happily with Elements at the moment.
Yeah, the finesse isn't there, and that's my issue.
Yeah, but you're always going to see that as a pro problem. Why shouldn't pros pay more is going to be a used thought process. So we'll just
say. Yeah, no, I mean, pros should pay more, but the option should be there. It's almost like a monopoly where it comes to RAW conversion, which it shouldn't. I'm pretty sure, as you know, an EU member, we're not allowed monopolies in the EU, are we?
No,
We need to annoy the French, because they're really good at jumping up and down about things like this.
Yeah.
And they invented it in the first place. So come on, French, get on with it.
Yeah, we should burn some sheep, definitely. Right, last story then. Luxe is a fantastic little device that clips straight over your iPhone, and it turns it into a proper light meter, in inverted commas. The people at Petapixel have got one of these things. They're only 20 quid. They fit over your camera eye, and with a little application that you get, it tells you what the light level is. And apparently, according to the little tests that they've run, it's highly accurate. Alex,
I'm just trying to pull something out of my bag.
Would you? Right, okay.
Right. I run on my iPhone, right, and it looks incredibly similar to the piece of software you're looking at.
Yeah.
And I'll never find this. The piece of software, which is, I think it's called Light Meter. So if I just type light into my phone, I can't find it. Okay. I do run a piece of software on my iPad called Light Meter, and I do remember it being a free piece of software. And I put that against my Western light meters, and I put it against the one that's in my flash kit, which is probably made by Bowens or someone, I can't remember now. And it was pretty close, but there were slight changes.
Yeah, but you're talking a stop at best.
But what I was going to say, I've got a little gadget in my bag, which is for taking color balances, and it's a bit like that piece of glass that they showed you that goes over the front of the camera. Mm-hmm. There, I put that on my light meter, because what that does, it dapples the light, and that's sort of how you do it. And then the light meter in my phone, my free light meter in my phone, became almost 99% as accurate as my Western. So this little thing they're talking about putting on front of their camera, I've been doing it only as tests, because it was a free bit of software. I've been doing it for a while. And those little bits of plastic, I've got some spare in, I think it's my flash kit, because you can have different fronts on the flash meter on my flash kit, on the light meter on my flash kit. So at some point, I might just take one of those out and put it on the iPhone to see if it checks. But that is available pretty accurately, and I'm pretty sure it was called Light Meter, and I've run it on my iPhone. It's a free piece of software, and it looks identical to the bit of software you showed on the picture when you put it up. So it's literally one of these conical, I can't think what the word is, but it does, it disperses the light evenly. so there's no direct light hitting it, hitting the camera lens, which is all that dome does. And it looks like it's using light meter. So as much as it's a brilliant idea, don't go paying for it, because there's free ways of doing exactly the same thing out there already.
Pete in the chat room has put a link in that says five alternatives to Photoshop for any Mac user. They've got GIMP, Pixelmator, PhotoLine, Pixel Image Editor, and Acorn. There's some others as well. Iris is in there. But I would say that you would probably see those as alternatives more viably for the consumer rather than the pro end, where you're talking about not batch processing, but you know, if you're talking about processing lots and lots of images continuously, I've had a go with GIMP, and GIMP's just painful for that kind of stuff.
I mean, look, Photoshop works. There's no two ways.
It does work, yes, but it's just overpriced.
Yeah, it's the best thing on the market, but not by a little way, by an enormous way. It's really daunting when you first look at Photoshop, because it's like, what the hell does all this mean? I'm never going to use most of this. And over the years, you start, well, you know what? That blending mode's really useful if I blend it in a darkened pattern.
Mm.
And then you might only use 10% of it, but that 10% could save you more money over a month in time than it would cost you to buy Photoshop. So there isn't an alternative, not at the pro end, but they are. What they've done with this Camera Raw thing is it's getting to the point where people are just going to start saying, you know, enough's enough. I would rather find any alternative than put up with this rubbish anymore.
Excellent. Your questions then? Here we go. If you've got a question for us, you can send it to us at britishtechnetwork@gmail.com and we'll answer it. Just put photo show on the top and then last your question and we'll do them. Everyone who writes in gets an answer, I promise you, and we'll read them out on the show. Question one, this comes from Lee. It says, hi chaps, thanks for the great show. I've written a couple of times before and I've bought two lenses on your recommendation, the 70-200 f4 and the Tamron 90mm macro. Thanks, blokes. I've three short and probably daft questions for you. What exactly is the AF on rear focusing thing and what's it used for? Autofocus, perhaps?
It's quite off. Yeah, no, maybe. Maybe. Yeah, carry on. You're breaking up really badly, actually. So just.
Oh, right. This was you last time. Have you got anything to add to that? I mean, AF on, as far as I can see, is just autofocus on. And
yeah.
It doesn't say what it's on, whether it's on a lens or whether it's on the camera body itself. So.
I mean, we're obviously talking about Canon, so to be honest, I don't.
Well, no, I don't know if he's talking about this is on the lenses or not. There's no AF on the 70-200 f4, as far as I'm aware. So.
Well, they have that.
You've got an AF and M switch.
No, I've just turned around a Nikon that's on my desk, and there's a button on the back that says AF on.
Right.
I've never pressed it in my life. What I
need to get a body, hang on.
Well, there's one on the back of this Nikon. But you know what? Obviously, it's not a button I use.
I've got no AF on the back of mine here.
Oh, there is one of mine. That's really confusing because he's got AF on and he's using a Canon. But anyway, I assume it's the ability to be able to use autofocus. If you like, you know, it sounds daft, but use autofocus only maybe when the button is pressed down.
Yeah.
So if you had autofocus turned off on the front of the camera, you could autofocus with your. It's only going by something I remember. I think you press it down for autofocus while you're holding it. And when you let go, the camera no longer focuses. And the reason you'd want to do that, say you were at a sporting event or when you were trying to photograph somebody running down the line, what you could do is you could get the focus for one person running down the line, so you've already got your depth of focus, and then take it out of autofocus, so next time you press the button, the camera isn't trying to refocus again.
Well, you can do focus lock, but I mean...
Yeah, but that's the other way around, isn't
yeah.
it? Focus lock is... you have focus on all the time, and then you do that to take the focus off, don't you? It's sort of the other way around. But this, it's as far as I know, I mean, I could actually get a manual and read it, because I never even noticed that button was on the camera.
Is this the first question we've had that's kind of stumped us?
Yeah, but only because I've never pressed that button.
I've never pressed it before either.
I'm going to press it.
I found it. No, I've just dug out my... I've got my old spare body was a 450D. I've just got that out, the sod all on it. I've just got out my D600, which is my backup body for video. There's nothing on it. I've just got out my 1DS Mark II. That hasn't got anything on it. And then lo and behold, my D6 has.
There you go.
It's got AF on the back of it, and I'm just trying to line some it up to see what I can do with it, but I can't get it to take a picture, so.
Yeah, I'd have to dig out some lenses and put some. Oh, no, it's got batteries in this camera.
All right, well, but we haven't looked at... See, this proves that we don't look up the questions before we try and answer them.
Unless, I'll tell you what it could be.
We're flummoxed.
Is this is your D6 the first camera you've got that's got full live view?
Oh, right, okay.
Because of thinking about the camera this is on, I reckon it might be something to do autofocus when you're shooting in live view and then having using the live view as the viewfinder only. And then you get like a focal lock using the live view.
I can't get far enough away.
We'll come back to that.
It won't try. Maybe it's the autofocus during video then.
Could well.
That's a possibility.
You know what? If I'd have read the questions before, I could have pulled out a book and found
We don't. That's the good point to make, actually. Is more often than not, we get the questions and I paste them into the document 5 minutes before we go on air. And we don't look them up beforehand. So
right,
we do answer them off the top of our head. Sorry?
Also, light optimizer. Again, that's a Canon thing. I know what the Nikon have a thing called, what are they called? I can't remember now. D something they call it. And what that basically is, it's an onboard processing thing that, D-lighting, that's what. It's an onboard processing thing that Nikon have, which I imagine is the same as the auto light optimizer. It just adjusts shadow and highlights. It gives you it's not quite as good, obviously, as Photoshop, but it gives you the ability to do an auto shadow highlight adjustment. If it works quite well when you take shots inside, which are a little bit dark, because it will do a shadow highlight adjustment for you. And all I can say is auto light optimizer is called D-lighting on Nikon, and that's exactly what it does. And I can go to the long exposure noise reduction. It is a useful feature because it does exactly what it says. Once you start taking long exposures, you can get noise for the opposite reason, funnily enough, of having noise on a dark exposure. A long exposure, you get more noise because there's too much light sometimes coming into the sensor, and you get a little bit of grain, and all it does, it measures highlight values and it, you know, reduces the grain. So I can answer those two.
Right.
And I can answer
the other one because I've had a play now. I've found a little lens and I've stuck it on and I've worked it out. The AF button is when you're in video mode, if something's moving or tracking and you want to refocus, you can hit the AF button and it will refocus whilst you're recording. It won't stop recording before you do it and you won't have to do it manually. It just makes the autofocus mode. It won't work if the manual switch is on your lens, obviously. But if you've got autofocus selected and you want to pan something and it's getting closer towards you, you can hit AF and it will track the focus. But you have to keep hitting AF. It won't track the focus on and off constantly. It's not a constant autofocus onwards. It's as it moves, you have to keep pressing AF and it'll constantly refocus. And that's going to mean that the noise of your lens is going to be a huge issue, because if you listen to the one that I've got on here at the moment, it's disgustingly loud.
Right, and I can tell you, because while you were talking, I managed to grab a Nikon manual, and it has many functions on the Nikon, but the main function is, the simplest function, it's the same as half-pressing your shutter.
Yeah. But it works in because you can't half press your shutter when you're in video mode.
No, but this is for camera mode.
Yeah.
So it's the same as half pressing your shutter. Why you wouldn't want to half press your shutter rather than do that? I suppose if you're not very stable, then maybe this is the best bet. So it's the same as half press shutter. There are things to do with predictive focus tracking, which is what I was talking about when you want, you know, you've got someone running along a plane that you've already want to focus on and keep it locked down to. And there's all these other priority settings for shutter release and stuff. So ignore those because they're complicated.
Lee,
so, I was right.
In summary, dude, read the frigging manual. Don't send us questions like that again where we don't know the answer, all right? I can edit this bit out because the chat room blanked. Apparently the video's gone. So no one will ever know that we swanned around there looking for an answer. Question two is from Gordon. He says, I've changed to Canon last year. And I've to fund the move, I sold a few bits of old tech, including my HD camcorder, unfortunately. I bought the 650D and assumed that there'd be a full auto for video and whenever my wife wanted to use it. How wrong was I? Well, you've got the autofocus on button, maybe. I don't know. How wrong was I? The autofocus is terrible and it focuses back and forth on its target and creates a lot of buzzing on the audio as the motor drives it. Do you have any tips? Yes. Autofocus issues aren't the camera for a start. They're nearly always the lens, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think with video, they do advise, I don't know what they're called again on Canon, but I think they're called whisper lenses on the Nikon.
Yeah, the pancake lens is silent, absolutely silent.
Yeah, I mean, that is an issue, and that always has been an issue with DSLRs when you're using the internal microphone. I don't know how old the 650D is, but I know that it was something that people were really, really complaining about. And so the newer cameras come with much quieter lenses, or they recommend
for 45 quid, you can get a Rode hot shoe mount condenser mic, which is just stunning and captures fantastic quality audio.
But
I
don't know if I'm remembering this wrongly, but the very, very original, the first DSLRs that did video didn't have external mic inputs or outputs, if that's the word you want. It was just the very early ones because it was a real problem.
They don't do a monitor out. They'll do a line in and that's it. Yeah.
But you can get a little bit of kit that.
But some of the mics do monitor out the external mics that you can add on, but you can get cheap add-on mics to go on for 40 quid. And there's a bloke called, I want to say Big Whale. I'll find out where it is and put it in the show notes, but there's a guy who custom makes microphones for you. They're not particularly cheap, but they're not that expensive. They're little condenser mics. He does clip tie mics and things like that. And they start at $40 just for a clip tie mic that's hardwired. They're very good.
I've got to be honest. I mean, there is very little reason why you couldn't do that yourself.
Yeah, I'm sure there is. You can go down to Radio Shacky type places or something like that. Windrider's going to check his D5100 and see if it's got an AF button on it. Good man. Gordon's also said, I've bought the Lupe so I can see better, but it's still hard to keep up with moving things and remember which way to turn the focus ring. I wondered if Magic Lantern Hack might do a better job, but it's still not out for the 650D. Magic Lantern won't help you at all with lens noise, mate. It was nothing to it, or focus. So forget about that. All you'll do is invalidate your warranty. Practice is with a focus ring. There is no other way of doing it. Find something, go out, video it, and practice it, and work out whether roll to the right shortens or it lengthens. And once you've worked that, and it's a muscle memory thing, then you'll be fine. Manual focus. If you're talking about tracking things like birds and so on as they come into land, that's the really good practice, isn't it? Dogs running towards you, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's just muscle memory. That's all it is.
Mm.
You know, there is no. Bearing in mind that you're probably not going to have the same length when you're videoing. I mean, if you're going to be videoing a dog running to you from 500 yards away, the tracking's going to be very, very, very slow. And if you're going to have a dog running to you that's 20 foot away to you, it's going to be very, very quick. There is no right and wrong. It literally is a matter of practice. And it's like so much else with photography. I mean, again, it's another thing that separates, if you like, the pro from the amateur, is the fact that something can happen to you very quickly in front of you. And it's not that you're cleverer or in any way no more than the amateur. It's just you've done it enough times that your instant reaction is the one that hopefully is right. And so, you know, to get from your level to, say, the level of you and that's been doing video daily for the last 6 months is just doing video daily for 6 months. You know, that's all there is. That's the only answer. You know, manual tracking and all the rest of it, it's fine for photography, but I don't think it has the same... what you produce in video actually doesn't seem to work so well if it's so beautifully smooth. You know, having something that's moving to you that, you know, has got the tiniest bit of out of focus as you're tracking, it adds to something. Maybe it's just like something that I, you know, noticed from older films, but... I wouldn't worry too much, unless it's completely out of focus. Don't worry. No. It's a moving image. It builds up an ambience. You don't have an ambience with an out-of-focus photograph, but you do have an ambience with a slightly soft video.
I'll second that, absolutely. I mean, I've just shot a video about a guy who, it was a safety video, and the guy had lost his friend a couple of years ago. He was crushed by a digger, and he wanted to explain it on camera. He got very passionate about it all. And the guy was moving all over the place, and I was kind of getting frustrated because I was losing him out of focus and then bringing him back a very short depth of field. And we watched it back, and we did one take, and then I said, right, let's just do that again, but you need to stay a lot stiller. And to be honest, the first take where he was moving in and out of focus and I was struggling to keep up with him, so it looks so much more visceral. It's far better as a take. It was more realistic, more edgy because of the movement and that kind of stuff. So don't get too picky about it all. And the other thing is, try and think about the focal point of the lens, because that's what moves forwards and backwards. So don't think about, especially if you're doing zooms for the focus. So as you move it, you're moving the point at which the focus of the lens will hit the sensor, and think about that moving rather than thinking about out is out and in is in for zoom out, zoom in. It's think of the focal point of the lens moving. That's far easier.
There is the one other, it's not so much a tip, but it's just factually correct what happens. When you're trying to track on anything with a manual focus, if you're, say, doing a video, and a good example is a dog running across you or running towards you, the first 2 seconds, the chances are you are going to be out of focus. But then you're going to get, you know, it doesn't take very long for you to then work out what the tracking speed with your hand is. So if you want a dog running towards you, don't expect to get the first second of the dog running towards you, but you've got editing. Once you cut off that first second, the vast majority of it's going to now be in focus because you've already got the speed of that turning of the focus ring.
Mm.
So the beginning will be out of focus, and even maybe the end might be a bit soft, but the vast majority, if you cut off the first second and maybe the last second, is going to be really nicely sharp, and I wouldn't worry about it too much.
Excellent. Last question. It's from Adam. He says, hey guys, as an X5 user, I'm looking to upgrade. My question would be, go to Sony A57. Would you recommend that? I've looked at the new A58, but it seems to be a step down from the A57. I know I don't have any money for a 77 or an A99, which would be my dream. I mainly shoot video and be using an external mic for it. Love the idea of the Sony range. And okay, yeah, the lenses are expensive. I don't mind investing in the Alpha range. If you're stepping from an X5, I would have said the world's your oyster, to be honest, unless he's got a pile of lenses that fit, but I can't. Are they Micro Four Thirds? They would fit a 57.
I thought 57 wasn't Micro Four Thirds, but it might be.
That's what I'm thinking. I don't know. I've no clue, mate. I've used an A55, which I thought was crap. And I've never gone back to the Sony range and had a play with it at all. So I can't really speak from any kind of knowledge on those. I would suggest that whatever you do is get yourself down to an independent camera shop and go and have a play. I mean, there's plenty of places. Adam's in the Midlands here. Get yourself into Birmingham and go and see the Calumet boys and get some recommendations off them. I can guarantee you they'll get hold of a Sony if they haven't already got one in stock for you to play with.
Yeah. But I mean, the Sony range, they really have dropped. I mean, I know we try not to be rude about camera manufacturers anymore because we can't take hate mail anymore. But Sony, when they first brought out their Alpha range, they wouldn't lead in the pack, but Canon and Nikon definitely turned around and went, hold on a minute, there's a real competitor in the market. And I'd say in the last two versions of the Sony, Canon and Nikon have probably turned around and gone, oh, well, they're only Sonys. And I think, I don't know why they've dropped the ball, because of their first attempt at the time, which was a high-resolution alternative, it had bits missing. It didn't have live view. Or if it did have live view, you couldn't focus with live. I remembered it was something so stupid that they'd missed off that I couldn't quite work it out. I mean, the A57, it's what it is. Unless you've got lenses that fit it and there's a reason that you want to stick with Sony, that sounds bad because I don't know much about it. All I know is, the last few cameras that they brought out, their DSLR ranges, weren't up to what the promise of their early ones is, and that's all I can say. Again, if I'd have read the question, I could have given you a better answer. But.
No, I mean, I've got to say, when I used the A55, it was a pleasant camera. It was okay. It did the job, but the pictures weren't that great. I had a couple of them back to kind of blow up and view them at a larger resolution in Photoshop. And the way I'd describe it is it was about as inoffensive as a Chris de Burgh concert. But at the end of it, it was a Chris de Burgh concert. And that was the point. It was a pleasant camera. It was a fairly boring camera. And it did an adequate job adequately. But that was it. You know, there was nothing that made me go, wow. Nothing that made me feel like it was setting itself apart from anything else that you could buy a lot cheaper, an awful lot cheaper.
Yeah. But that's the shame, isn't it? Because Sony they were someone to look at. Some of their compacts, by the way, are incredible. Some of their compacts, you could say are the best on the market at the moment. You know, some of these RXs, or I can't remember which ones they're called, but they're amazing cameras. But they're somewhere in the line, Sony have lost the will to do DSLR, in my opinion, because from where they were, they've sat back, and both Canon and Nikon, and to a certain extent Pentax, have just left them standing. And I don't know if the lenses you've got are compatible and you particularly like Sony because you've got used to it. But I would say go to a camera retailer, ask to play with a Sony, then ask to play with a comparatively priced Canon, Nikon, or Pentax, and then see if you really want a Sony or not.
Not. Sorry.
I just know the hate mail is going to come in, and I'm trying not to be hateful.
I live for it. I live for the hate mail, mate. Right. This podcast and all the others is brought to you by UK2.net. They're stunning. They're spangly. We had a note from them this week because we've renewed all of the British Tech Network domains and that kind of stuff with them. And, you know, are you guys happy with what you're getting? And they say, you're giving us some fantastic traffic. You're giving us lots and lots of custom. The people that listen to British Tech are buying service off us. We're very, very happy with what we're doing. We're happy to continue as long as you are. And we are continuing. That's the end of it. You know, it's dead easy. They pick up our bandwidth and they don't charge us a penny. And it's because you guys buy service from them. If you go to uk2.net, you can get discount codes from us for everything that they buy, everything that they sell to you. We're the only people that have got that many offer codes. The key, though, is to go through our website, britishtechnetwork.com, and then you click on the sponsors page, go through there, and then we get kudos for having sent you. If you don't, it just appears like you've got the voucher codes off a voucher codes page on the net. Please use ours. There's a tracking link that just makes sure that they know that we sent you. It doesn't track you, it tracks us. And buy anything that you want for the web from UK2. You'll probably find the price is pretty good anyway, and you're getting reductions on top of that. They've got everything you could possibly want. Check them out. And if you don't like what you see, write to me and tell me, and I'll tell them. There you go. Where can we get a hold of you, Alex?
You can get me at Alex G. Fox on Twitter. Thank you very much.
And currently poring over maps, trying to get roads and rivers to line up.
Yeah, there's things that probably aren't even there anymore. Yeah. I could just take them off and no one would know.
Told you, I don't know why you're bothering, mate. They're probably wrong anyway. They're so old.
Yeah, probably. Well, there's nothing left under Yorkshire. They dug it all up and burnt it, haven't they?
Good point. I'm Ewan Rankin. You can get me at Ewan Rankin on Twitter, and you can send your stuff here for Photoshop, for photography questions, rather not Photoshop questions, Jesus, to britishtechnetwork@gmail.com. We've also got the Bash coming up on the 6th of July. We're going to put up booking for tickets for that soon. But if you want to book yourself a hotel, use the postcode B36, book yourself a hotel room for the night of the 5th and the 6th, and there's a curry on the 5th and the Bash on the 6th. So we'll see you soon. Take care. Thanks for listening. Bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting.